From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Thank you for tuning in to episode number 124, where I am joined by extraordinary woman Trudy Ann Tellis. Trudy Ann lives in Vancouver, British Columbia, with her husband and sons, and takes care of her mum, who also lives with them, plus Coco, her dog, of course. Trudy owns and runs an organic chai and spice company called Trudy Ann's Chai and Spices, and you can buy some of her fabulous tea and spice blends on her website, trudyannschai.com. She also runs vegetarian cooking classes online and attends many events in the US and Canada with her teas and spices. Sign up to her newsletter to find out when she is going to be in a town near you and go meet her in person. I had a feeling this was going to be one of those chats that ran into two parts, and I was right. Trudy Ann is a whirlwind with lots to share, so let's get started with the first part now. Welcome, Trudy Ann, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's lovely to be here, finally.
Yes, we've been talking for a while via email, haven't we? But it's been a partly catching you at home because you travel all over the place, don't you?
I do. I try to go to India once a year, and that's where I was when we were talking. And I was also in a remote part where there was not going to be internet to do this. And I also travel a lot for my work, part of my business. I go around the US and Canada tea festivals, which is fun, and craft shows. So yeah, it's sometimes hard to catch me. But here I am back in Vancouver.
Very busy woman. I'm lucky to have caught you in a down week. Well, you've also been poorly as well, haven't you? Which is not good.
Yeah. I've been sick the last week and I never get sick, but I could feel that my body needed to just be sick. Sometimes we need to just let our body do what it needs to do. So I stopped drinking all my teas because I blend a lot of teas, and I stopped the bone broth. I pretty much stopped everything and allowed my body to do what it needed to do. And now I'm on the mend. So thanks.
Sometimes I think we often want to take something to get rid of the problems associated with an illness, a sickness of some kind. But often, like you say, your body just needs to go through it, doesn't it? It's like the compulsion always is to bring a fever down. That's what you want to do, and that's what you're actually often told to do. But unless you're at a dangerous level where you have to bring that temperature down, actually it's your body's way of getting rid of the problem, isn't it, by elevating that temperature to burn it out of your system.
Totally. I'm such a workaholic that I don't know how to rest, and I thought, you know what, this is a great excuse to stay in bed and just watch some mindless stuff on your computer or catch up on podcasts. But the funny part about not being sick the last couple of years was every time I found myself about to get sick, I would blend a new tea, like, oh, this is going to save me. And it did. And finally, I thought, just stop all the remedies and just let your body, listen to your body, you know. And this week, I'm actually nourishing my body now. I'm done being sick, and now it's into the bone broth and nourishing my body with good fats. So yeah. It's good to be here and good to have my voice back too. It's mostly back.
Well, it sounds like you're very in tune with yourself. And you mentioned there about visiting India, and people might have picked up a bit of an accent. So why don't you tell us about you? Tell us where you came from originally and how you got where you are today.
Firstly, my name really is Trudy Ann. I don't have an Indian name, because there happen to be a few Catholic Christians in India that do have Western names. So my name's Trudy Ann, and I was raised in Bombay, now called Mumbai, India. And to tell you a little bit about, I guess, my youth and how I was raised. So I was actually a very skinny little child growing up. Like, skinny, you could touch me and I would probably blow over. And people make jokes about me because I was so skinny. And I grew up on traditional Indian food. And what that meant was, you know, we did have three meals a day, but very small portions. So it was, breakfast would be like maybe one or two chapatis. And I remember there was always a lot of butter, melted butter or ghee on it. And lunch would be often like small portions, you know. In India, if you're aware, we have these thalis or stainless steel plates with little metal bowls. I don't want to talk too much about food or description, because it might make some people hungry, and we don't really want that. But, you know, lentils and a little portion of vegetables, maybe some meat, but not necessarily. Afternoon, there was a little rice, but it was often we called it the boiled rice, but it's the rice which is not the processed rice. But everything was very small portions, and there was always the melted ghee or the butter fat on the table. And because I was so skinny, I remember every summer they sent me to my auntie's house, my family home in Mangalore in South India. It's on the coast. So not to be confused with Bangalore, but Mangalore with an M. There we had, you know, we had mango trees in the garden and coconut everywhere. And I remember she would make this sweet lentil soup. And again, it had a lot of coconut in it, so all the good fat. And we cooked on wood-burning stoves there. And part of my job was to go and, you know, watch the rice or watch the lentils on these wood-burning stoves. So sitting with traditional cooks and watching how they eat, I think it was really good for my healing many, many, many years later. You know, that memory of that childhood and what we ate there. But it also meant that I, we'd eat mangoes every day. And I gained the weight, but it was all good fat. And as kids, if you're having mangoes, you also, at that day, we didn't have cell phones or even any phone for that matter in our family home. So we would just burn it running in the fields or climbing up trees. And one of our jobs was actually to watch the coconuts dry in the sun. So, you know, we had to walk like about a mile with the coconuts to this big field. And there was so much physical energy, which you could eat more food because we expended it. But I wanted to also add, like, if we had desserts, then ice cream was like a rarity. So we would have a tiny, like, quarter cup serving and savor it. You know, you don't like guzzle it down. You just took your time. But even then, the fake oils, the bad oils, the white flour was all creeping into India. And I didn't eat a lot of it, but I definitely ate it. So that's kind of where I was food time. And one amazing memory is my grandma Mona. every single day at 7 p.m. She called us inside from playtime and said, come drink the broth or drink the soup. And I just took it for granted, but I never realized how much nourishment I was getting from all this food. That's kind of like tells you a little bit about my diet. So I wasn't like huge or anything. But then when I was around, I think it was 11 or 10, 11, 12, somewhere around then, I started getting grand mal seizures. Like I had full on epilepsy. Yeah. And it evolved. Like initially it was once every 4 months, 5 months. And as I got older, it was every month for like a week I was in bed. But I've always had this philosophy that the diseases that I have are not me. I have a personality that's not connected to my disease. I'm who I am, and I would never allow that to take over my life. I'd never sit and say, oh, poor me. You know, it's like, oh, God, I have a, oh, great. I hope it happens on a weekend, and then I can do what I need to do on Monday. So that basically changed a lot of things for me, though. I had to, you know, deal with this disease. I was still skinny, though. And then I came to North America when I was 17 for a year as an exchange student to actually the Midwest. I was in Wisconsin, or Wisconsin, as they say, in a little town called Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. It was great. I loved the Midwest. I loved the hospitality, and I loved the food. You know, it's lots of, big amounts of steak and potatoes. And I was like 98 pounds or something at the time, like really skinny. And coming from India, you learn that, you know, you're not going to waste any of the food. So I ate everything. And at the end of the year, I was 120 pounds, which may not seem like a lot to most people. But if you've been under 100 pounds, that is a lot. Mm. Portions I'd never in my life seen ice cream, for example, and from those quarter cups. So yeah, I was like the starving kid. And I went, oh, well, let me eat it all. They're giving it to me.
Well, all those portions must have blown your mind. I mean, America is renowned for its large portions, isn't it? So going from where you were when you said about growing up, everything was in small portions, it must just have been this monumental disparity between the two.
Yeah. I have this childhood memory where I was sitting around my dining table with my brothers, and we have this in India, and I think in a lot of cultures, you serve your guests first, you know. We had a lot of guests in our house, and these two, I think they were American travelers that came to visit us, and these poor guys, you know, they'd been traveling 3 months in India having vegetarian food, and my grandmother brings out like a big steak or something. But how we did it was cut up, and each of us got a little tiny portion of steak, you know, like a luncheon meat. Maybe I got one, and maybe my brothers took two. And I remember these two guests coming, and they, between the two of them, they ate our entire steak for the whole family. Wow. And my grandmother kicked me from under the table, and she shook her head, meaning, you know, I looked at her and went, that's my dinner. And she said, no, they're, you know, like, that's the guest. Don't talk about it. But it gave me so much to think about years later when I came and lived here, about why there is an obesity epidemic and why, well, you know, this is what we all talk about today, this whole epidemic of food and diabetes. But I remember that moment at my dining table, not having the meat that night. And it was, in the end, it was not a big deal because, you know, the guest had our dinner. But yeah, all about portion control, and that's so important for me today. Sorry, I digress there.
It shows also that, yes, it is about portion, but it's completely about portion size in what you're talking about. But it also shows that it's really wrapped up with what's normalized for you. So you were brought up with certain size portions and that seemed normal. So you go to America and these portions seem huge. Whereas you take someone who's been brought up in America, take, you know, you in your typical family where you are, and your American counterpart who's grown up with the typical normal size portions to them. But there's a complete disparity between the two. But to each of you, that's normal.
Right.
And you can see where it's very easy to judge someone's sense of what's a normal portion, but when you actually look at it from that perspective, where it's just something they've grown up with, that's normal, that's what they've acclimatized to over the years and taken for granted.
Yeah.
But you can see how it's a problem, but you can also see how it's just completely normal.
Right. And I totally adapted, right? I went to Wisconsin and I ate those big portions and my one meal could have fed four people around my table, what I was eating. But it reminds me of one thing. We had a lot of exchange students stay with us in India and they would typically visit us. They were pretty overweight. Like I would say a lot of them were 40 pounds overweight. And by the end of the year, having our diet, they all dropped down to their normal weight, which was really extraordinary. But I never gave it much thought then. But today it makes perfect sense.
Really fascinating, you know? With hindsight, yeah. Seeing that weight reversal, depending where you are, what you're eating and how much of it.
Yeah. But when I returned to India, this is from when I was 17, right? And I'd gained 20 pounds. Indians are kind of brutally honest, just not sometimes so nice, but they pretty much looked at me and said, "Oh my gosh, you're fat." And I went, yeah, but it was so hurtful, you know, and you didn't want to be reminded of it. So I tried a whole bunch of various things then to lose the weight. And I think I did. I went back to Indian diet, but I think some things from my body having eaten the way I was eating for 1 year, it took me a very long time to change those habits. And then by that time, I was also, I think, eating for emotional reasons too. So I lost, I'd say, most of that weight. And then I returned to the United States to go to graduate school. Again, I did some training in the Midwest and then I went to Syracuse. And at Syracuse, I was like a poor student. So I ate whatever, you know, carbs and cheap carbs and all that stuff. And that period, I then gained 48 pounds. So I was almost 150 pounds. And I stopped at that point. I mean, I was still eating some Indian food. I was definitely still eating the lentils, but I had also switched over to sugar and carbs and no moderation at all. The only thing I remember always eating was still the fats, like good fat. I still liked butter. So maybe that saved me in the end. So then this is like, many years later, I'd say I'm in my 20s and I'm living in the San Francisco Bay Area then. I used to be a special ed teacher there. And one of my friends had suggested to me that I should try having tofu shakes to lose weight, soy shakes. And well, I talk about this quite a lot on my website, but it's got so many side effects. But long story short is I didn't lose the weight. I was at that point also taking a drug called valporic acid for my, it's got a different name. I can't remember. Depakote. I think it was Depakote for my epilepsy.
I was going to ask you what was happening with your epilepsy? Because you started off talking about your epilepsy and saying that it affected you for about 1 week every month, which is significant. What happened during this period, you know, when you were in the US? And I was just thinking about that as you were talking about this sort of deterioration in your diet and wondering how that impacted it.
I'm kind of one of those persons that I never try to make my health issues a big deal. Like I could say, oh, woe is me, I've got all these issues. But I also love living life. So definitely when I was sleep deprived or when I was a teenager, you know, I would drink alcohol when we went out, you know, with friends and I would pass out, I mean, have a seizure and pass out. So that was a no-brainer. I stopped alcohol. And it's funny that I couldn't pass on the same knowledge about alcohol to food, right? Because the food wasn't making me pass out then, but it was accumulated damage. So I continued. There was never a break with my seizures. And I remember seeing specialists telling me then, oh, you should try that keto diet. And I had no idea what they're talking about. But if that same neurologist had handed me a piece of paper with a diet that says, if you need to have this, that's your medicine, of course I would have done it. Mm. I'm the patient, you're the doctor. I will do anything the doctor says, you know, because I'm a good patient. So I had no idea. It sounded like something super scary, you know, if someone had told me today to have bacon and eggs, I'm in. They tried me on so many different medications for the epilepsy. I had too many to name. And these medicines were making me neurologically, like I was just having memory loss. I couldn't remember. I couldn't function. Mm-hmm. And somehow I had to take myself to teaching inner city special ed students in Oakland every day. So in the end, the only medication that really worked for me was phenobarbital, which my pharmacist had told me the only people that they give this to currently were dogs. And I was laughing because it's one of the older ones, but it worked for me.
It's difficult, isn't it? I can remember spending time with some people who had epilepsy and it was this dilemma all the time. The medication definitely helped, but the side effects were often just left them feeling so not good all the time that they often ended up going off their meds and saying, you know, I would rather have the seizures from time to time than feel like this all the time. So it's very difficult, I think, when you have a condition where the medication that treats it also makes you feel bad. It's this toss up between, well, which is worse, which is the one I'd rather live with. I'm interrupting for a moment to tell you about Superfat, who I'm thrilled to say have asked to partner with me and the podcast again. Listen out over the coming weeks for exciting news about a new range of products they are launching at the end of March. But for now, let's talk nut butters. They are conveniently packaged in serving-size pouches, but also now a couple of flavours are available in large 6.2-ounce pouches, so you can use them for recipes or to share or not to share, if you are me, who doesn't like to share such yummy treats. I'd recommend getting the variety box so you can try all the flavours, which are all delicious. I really like the fact that they're not too sweet. So often, products like this are heavy-handed with the sweetener, which spoils them a bit for me. These have just the right amount, and a couple of flavours don't have any in at all. Check out all those delicious flavours, variety packs and the new large pouches at superfat.com and use code DAISY to get 15% off your order. As usual, the link is also on my links page at links.ketowomenpodcast.com as well as in this week's show notes. Give them a try. You won't be disappointed. Thank you for taking the time out to listen and thanks to Superfat for supporting the podcast. Now let's get back to Trudy Ann.
With the epilepsy at that time, so I would say for about 35 years from when I had epilepsy until later when I had brain surgery, and I can talk about that a little later, but I would have, I would say every month, about a couple of seizures. They were also at that point tied into my cycle because my body was run down. I was a little sleep deprived and they were definitely tied into sleep deprivation, but I suffered from insomnia, and I'm thinking because of all the sugar and caffeine and everything else I was eating, so it's a vicious cycle. But somehow I was able to deal with the seizures in that I had a seizure, I stayed in bed, I was like, great, someone's going to make me tea in bed. I just have a funny way of looking at life, you know. Life dishes you something, and you can either say, oh my God, my poor me, or you can just say, okay, deal with it, rest, and on Monday, the moment you're better, do the things you want to do. And that's how I've been, you know. So basically, my story is kind of tied in with the epilepsy. So in 1992, 93, I think it's 93, I basically, at that time, was doing the tofu shakes, you know, the soy shakes to lose weight because I was about 148 pounds. And I was also on a drug called Depakote, but I was on Depakote for 5 years, which is usually you don't see side effects then, but I think one of the side effects is also pancreatitis. But I also know that a lot of soy consumption, and I was eating a lot because I really wanted to lose weight, is also associated with pancreatitis. And I've definitely seen on some of the sites I respect, I've seen them talk about this. So, yep, I was in hospital with hemorrhagic pancreatitis in my 20s, in intensive care for 2 months, and I had multiple surgeries. And it was brutal. It's very painful. And I still wasn't saying, woe is me. I had a thing that I'm going to kick this and get out of it, or out of hospital, even though I think they had told my husband, we were newly married then, that we're going to operate on her. But it was kind of a touch and go. I was code blue several times. And I don't know, at one point I counted, there were like 8 tubes coming out of me, you know. So it's just what it was. But I did get out of hospital, and what they told me was they initially wanted to send me home with a G tube, you know, those tubes that they put into you to feed you, because I wasn't eating. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I lost the weight, but that's a pretty brutal way to lose your excess weight. I would never want it. Yeah. And my mom, this is a funny story. My mom came to visit me to help me out, but they wouldn't let me leave hospital until the tray was empty, the food tray. So I gave her all my food to eat. But I mean, obviously I was still losing weight, but I would say, oh, look, I ate my food. Let me go home today. But they did tell me I would have to have insulin one day, but my body was still producing insulin at the time. So that's kind of where I'm at, up to the point where I was very sick. And then it starts after that. It's like I try to get my body well, and I did a lot of research after I came out of from having pancreatitis. Actually, I didn't do the research; my husband did. I didn't even bother. I would have gone on eating my same bad diet. It's terrible. It's awful to say this and admit it, but I don't know that I would. I didn't have the physical energy to research at that point. I guess
you just needed somebody else to. Like you said before, just give you a plan and say, do this.
Right.
Don't have to figure it out. I just want someone to tell me what to do.
Yeah. I could say that post-pancreatitis, like I look at my life as there's like these two categories. It's post-pancreatitis and then it's post-epilepsy and brain surgery, which I had in 2012. So just with the post-pancreatitis, if I can talk about that, my husband got this book called Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon of Weston A. Price Foundation. And I feel like if people don't have that book, it's the one book that it's great to have in your kitchen as a recipe book. But that book saved my life because we came out of hospital and John started making me bone broth and these soups and it was just such good food, and I got well again, and I never really gained that weight back again. I was definitely then, I had some clue. I was definitely eating in moderation, but I was still eating, you know, bread and okay, sugar and all that stuff, you know, waiting for the day I'd be officially diabetic. But that book, I remember there were so many, I ate so much fat, like good cheeses and raw cheese. And our family started having like raw cream and raw milk. It's not currently, you can't legally get it in here in Canada, but we could get it in the US. We lived there then from a grocery store. So I was eating clean and organic and I have been since I've had pancreatitis, like good oils and all that stuff. But like I was saying, there was still the cheating with the carbs and all that stuff, right? And I remember my GP telling me one day, she did like a panel of tests, and she said, this is when I was diagnosed as diabetic, which was in 2004, after a period of great stress. I really apologize because I'm jumping from one date to another, but it's hard even for me to remember so many things that have happened to me. So yeah, 2004, after great stress with my job and everything, I was officially diabetic. So, you know, I was put on all the classic diabetic drugs like metformin and glyburide. And actually, I was put on 2,500 milligrams of metformin. It did nothing for me. Like my fasting sugars were still anywhere from 10 to, I don't know, 18, 19, 20. One time they were 22. It's very high. Mm. You know, I can't convert it to the other way, but I think it was like anywhere from 180 to 400. And I was skinny. So people were, oh, you're so skinny. You're so lucky. Like, well, should I tell you how high my sugars were today? Maybe not. So she told me this GP had never seen anyone who was so highly diabetic with amazing, amazing good cholesterol. And I said, well, I eat all this fat and I follow the principles of, Weston A. Price Foundation. I was by then working for a cure, like a magic pill. And I think I spent thousands of dollars on Indian remedies and herbs and just whatever concoction someone told me, oh, this is going to work.
Try it.
So, yeah. And nothing was working. Moving forward, 2012, I had brain surgery. And when you were saying earlier about your friends who stopped the medicine? Mm. Well, they did that in the seizure investigation unit because I had to be admitted for a year before for many weeks. Like I think it was 3 weeks or a month. I don't remember. They had to trigger seizures to see where they were coming from.
Yeah.
And this is the really interesting part, is that they were coming from my left frontal lobe and they stopped the medication. So I was getting something like multiple seizures every day. So, you know, for me, I needed the medication. You know, it was brutal. That was probably more brutal than having epilepsy because you suddenly see what happens to your body without the medicine. Mm-hmm. And I would not have been able to have a life without medication. When my neurosurgeon looked at this and he came and talked to me, he said, I'm shocked that nobody did this surgery 20 years ago. And I said, why? He said, you know, you have this cavernoma. It's right in the front and so easily accessible. I had this, it's not a simple surgery, but it was fairly straightforward and they took it out. But knowing what I know about keto today, I think I could have avoided brain surgery. I could have happily avoided brain surgery had someone handed me a prescription. And, you know, and I wonder why the doctors I know, my friends, they're so resistant to trying food that can actually save someone's life. And they go, oh, I'd never have my patient fast even 12 hours. Like, okay, fine. You know, but anyway, so after epilepsy was when I talked to myself, I had a conversation with myself and I said, you're seizure free, Trianne. It is time for you to figure out your diabetes. You have no more excuses. So yeah, that's kind of what happened post brain surgery 2012 was, okay, it's Trianne time. And now you've got to figure out how you're going to take care of your body. And also, to add something, our family used to live in San Francisco, the San Francisco Bay Area that I loved, but I did have a pretty stressful job. And we had made a decision as a family to move to Canada. And we ended up in Vancouver, BC, which is, I love it. And a big part of that was to for me to take care of my health, but also to try to find ways to de-stress our lives. So things that were causing a lot of stress before, like a big house with a big, beautiful house with a big, beautiful yard and the American dream, all those things at the end of the day, they're not going to give you that much happiness. Maybe for society, you look great because they go, oh, look, she's got a nice house. But how are you? How is your body inside with having to pay for all those things, you know? I'm way happier in living in Vancouver. I love the Bay Area, but I'm happier and healthier living out here because it gave me time to take care of me.
So what was that when you decided to step back a bit and take some time for you and take some time to figure out the best way forward, diet-wise and stress-wise as well, by the sounds of it? What happened? What led you down the keto? And I know fasting is a big part of your life too. What triggered that? How did you find that? Is it something? I always find it very interesting. It's often a book someone read or a video someone's seen or something a friend has given them. It's really interesting to find out what set you on the right path.
So multiple things. I really like a challenge. And if someone tells me you can't do it, like the doctor saying to me, oh, you're going to have a G-tube and you'll have to have insulin pump. That's a challenge for me. So the reason I knew my body could do it was this. I had pancreatitis in the 90s, so 1993 or something like that. I had brain surgery in 2012. However, I was only diagnosed as a diabetic in 2004. So what was happening between all those years when my pancreas was able to produce? Mm-hmm. How come it stopped? So in 2003 to 2004, so 1 year, my boys were very little then. They were, you know, 3 and 7 or something. And I had children too, by the way. I had two boys in the middle of having all these diseases. And I'd spare you that because this podcast would never end if I talk about that. There's more references to that in on my website if someone wanted to read like the complete story. But I'll spare you that because it's too much, even for me to talk about. But when we lived in India, I was eating traditional Indian diet, you know, walked everywhere. And my blood sugars were fantastic. All my labs, you know, it was normal. I came back to the San Francisco Bay Area, back to my job, you know, the holidays. So the sabbatical, it was over. It was time to reality. But I had a very bad stress at my job. And it was brutal. Like I was in a school where we were, you know, it was a job I chose to do, but it was stressful. We were in a school where we were locked in and locked down, like just to protect students and us. And right away, like I came back to the States in August, and by September, I was on all this medication for diabetes and cholesterol and you name it. And I thought, that's weird. Mm. You know, how could that happen? And of course, I wasn't stressed in India. So when we sat down to talk about moving and leaving the Bay Area, a big component was how do we de-stress our lives? So, you know, until 2012, definitely epilepsy and was a very stressful, even though I downplayed it. Obviously, you know, I could never, my business was a hobby. Like I have this company called Trudianne's Chai, and I just went to little farmers markets and craft shows because it was something I could do. And I had to really thoughtfully plan it because I couldn't have a seizure. Like, I couldn't have a show across country because, you know, what am I going to do if I have a seizure? I can't go there. 2012, a friend gave me a book about a raw vegan diet for curing diabetes. And I said, yep, I'm going to try it. I did try it, but I'm the kind of person who ate mostly raw, but I had to include my fats. I couldn't do, it just isn't in what I believe in, actually. So I definitely had a lot of raw juices and raw salads, but then I would sometimes just have a little bit of fish and the raw meats. And that worked pretty well. That actually, it wasn't, my blood sugars weren't perfect because I was still eating three meals a day. And I was still on all this medication. And my fasting sugars definitely at that point had dropped down. My A1C had dropped to like maybe 6 or 5.9 or something like that. But then I had a stressful period again in 2016. I was actually writing a book and it was stressful because I gave myself a timeline. And, you know, I wish we didn't give ourselves timelines because nobody else is giving us that timeline. Nobody asked me to write the book or have it published by a certain day. Why do we do this? Right? I don't know why we do this. But yep, my sugars then crept up to something like 300 and 400. And I was eating clean food. I was pretty much eating good food. So I was put on insulin. This is 2000 and I think 16 or 17. I don't know. Maybe 16. And not a lot of insulin, but I had classic side effects right away with the insulin. I had joint aches. I gained weight. So that was terrifying for me, like 1 pound a day. And the way insulin works is that the longer you take it, the more you need. It's like any of my medications, they stop working after a point. And I was injecting more insulin. And one of the scary part of having, for me, having something like insulin, it's like an excuse. Oh, yeah, I can eat more today. I can take insulin. And that's a huge mistake that I think a lot, I don't think I'm alone in this. I think a lot of us go like, yay, I have my insulin. I'll just take a little shot. It's so dangerous. And one of the issues with insulin too is that your sugars can go dangerously low, as what's happened to me too. I've had dangerously low sugars. So I didn't want it. And so 2017, I think we were in Hawaii, my family. We went to visit some family there. So, you know, I'm not stressed. I'm eating clean food. I hadn't eaten carbs or anything, but I'm eating three meals a day. Again, high sugars, you know, they were over 150. And I, late night, I did this on Google. I searched for fat, like butter. I didn't think what I was eating because I knew I was eating good food, grass-fed meat, put fish. And I waited to see some, you know, gimmicky site with an ad that says, pay me your money. And up pops Diet Doctor. And it was like midnight or something. And I'm in this family home and I clicked on Diet Doctor. And I went, what's the catch? What's the catch? There's got to be a catch somewhere and there's no catch. I mean, you know, there's a membership, but that's not a big deal. You pay a membership. That's nothing compared to what money we give our food industry. And one thing led to another. I watched all Dr. Fung's videos. I decided I was going to make an appointment with the fasting method run by Megan Ramos. And I thought, I need to pay money. These people are now talking my talk. They're prescribing to me the food I eat. That's awesome. I even saw references to Weston A. Price Foundation. And I was deliberately going there because I'm so knowledgeable. I went to see, do they support the sites that have fed me basically and nourished my body? I then decided, like, you know, we don't like to pay money to donate money to things that where people like you are working so hard to get message across. You know, we have to think like 10 times, and yet we'll donate money to someone doing Girl Scout cookies for a fundraiser, and those cookies are filled with junk that caused the cancer in the first place. You know, if you look at the ingredients, I mean, it's just an example. So I thought, don't think twice. Join the fasting method, and I did. I mean, it was called IDM then, and I booked a one-to-one consultation, and the first consultation I had was with Angel Ramos, and he just fine-tuned it. He just talked about fasting, and I did get Dr. Fung's book, so I don't believe in just doing something without research. It's stupid, especially when I'm on so much medication, right? It's just, I think for people who self-medicate, it's not a smart idea. Like, I didn't actually consult with my GP because my GP at the time was pretty obese. And I have since got him on keto, actually.
Well done.
yeah, it took a bit of time to work with him. And Megan Ramos to date is still helping me with my fasting because I'm a little bit of an unusual case because I don't have much of a pancreas. I think that was the best thing. The best money I ever spent was on those consultations on the books recommended by all these keto podcasts. You know, the books, I have referred all of them to my website and I don't get paid by any of them. I just believe in supporting people like you that are trying to get a message across. And it's such a hard job. So I've come a long way and I can tell you how dramatically my body changed, if you'd like to hear that, you know, from eating healthy since for a while and trying, you know, raw food and what's happened with the stress and how that made things worse again.
So was it an immediate, you know, you went down the diet doctor rabbit hole. It's a great site, isn't it, for people,
awesome.
Research
awesome.
Junkies. It's just, yeah. There's absolutely so much. I can remember looking at it in the early days and you could do your membership and I can remember going through everything in a month or whatever.
Yep.
But now, I mean, the content that they've got on there now is just incredible. And interestingly enough, actually, and my friend Kim mentioned this the other day, and I got an email about it as well. They will be there filming at Low Carb Denver. So anyone who's been considering trying out the Diet Doctor membership, it is absolutely free for the first month. And if you were to sign up now, you'll be able to see the live stream of Low Carb Denver. So, I mean, you know, what a fantastic opportunity that is, because it's a fabulous conference to go to. I went to it last year, but it's very expensive. It would be expensive to buy the live stream. And here you can get it for free via the Diet Doctor website. So I really advise anyone to go and check that out and sign up.
It's funny you say that. I was about to mention just that, but now you've saved me from doing that. But what I wanted to say in tying in with you, for people who can't afford it, where money is an issue, go to Diet Doctor, go to the fasting method. There's a lot of sites established. But what I like about Diet Doctor is they have all these videos from the experts. And even if you have to pay for a few memberships, it's still cheaper than going to see a specialist. It is still better than any advice your regular GP will give you as well.
Well, and they have a huge amount for free anyway.
They do.
It's not like you've got to pay anything to access the information because there's lots of information there for free. But anyway, like I say, you can sign up for a month completely free of charge anyway. So you went down the Diet Doctor rabbit hole and that led you to IDM or the fasting method that it's now known as. But so what did you then, you made a plan and you started implementing it when you came back from holiday, presumably?
Oh, I did it in Hawaii right away. I didn't waste one second. I just was like, I'm doing this today. And it just meant tweaking, you know, for me. I was just trying to figure a way out by myself, fumbling until the book arrived, The Fasting Method, and until I got an appointment. And I went straight from like Diet Doctor to now let's just immerse myself in, at that time it was IDM. So, you know, with Jason Fung and Megan Ramos. And my first consultation, what Angel did for me was basically telling me, I don't need to do these marathon long, you know, days and days of fast because for my body, I get nauseous pretty easily. That's just been a childhood thing. And so I was doing shorter fasts, like maybe 24-hour fasts or 36-hour fasts, and I built into the longer ones. And my goal was one thing only. I had to repair the damage, my beta cells that are so damaged in my pancreas. I knew that they can heal again. And I understood by then a little, I'm not a doctor, but I think in a way I'm nice for doctors because I do all the work. And I'm like an experimental guinea pig, you know, I'll try anything new. So just fasting, and I was first eating two meals a day, and I have a journal in which I write data about my moods, what I'm eating, if I'm having, you know, did I cheat? Exactly what I'm eating. Is it cooked food or is it raw food? Because it makes a difference. Because at the end of the day, I don't have a working pancreas. And sometimes it's frustrating because I go into all these, you know, groups and I see, oh, they just started 1 month and their A1C is 4.9 and mine is still 5.8. But I have to remind myself that years of damage to my body are going to take me years of work. You know, for what I did, not what I did, what just what I'm not blaming myself. It's just what was the circumstances at the time. So then Megan Ramos started help coaching me, and I told her my what I wanted to do was get my A1C further down. It was, I don't know, 6.2 then. It used to be 10.3 and it went down to 5.8. So currently I haven't actually tested. I'm due to go and have an A1C done. And when I do, I'll, you know, tell you what the levels are, but it has to have gone down, because when I fast, and today I will do like 48-hour fast, but I break it with bone broth and I do green juices and lots of salt. I feel like that's the only way my body can do it. And when I do that, my fasting sugars are usually 4.9, and I'm literally doing a little dance, you know, around my machine. So it's working.
Yeah.
And to the doctors that told me I'd need insulin and all of that stuff, like, nah. Well, if I can do it with my body, it's so much easier for someone who has an intact pancreas. I'm still a work in progress. For example, when I eat, I have to finish eating around 8 a.m. or latest 9 a.m. and then I can drink tea. I can have like a little bit of bone broth if I feel like it, but my body needs so much. It needs like a lot of extra time to process this food. But I've also figured out that for me, because of trying to give my pancreas not too much work, and actually this is how I ate when I was recovering from pancreatitis. It's back to Sally Fallon's and Nourishing Traditions. So it's bone broth, and I'll put things like bok choy and some dark green stuff. I've discovered something called konjac noodle, which has fiber, and it seems to work pretty well, little amounts of it.
Yeah, so like the miracle noodles type things, aren't they? I was talking to Terry Lance, posted the other day, the fettuccine type noodles. And I said they looked like they had a bit more give to them. And I was trying to think in my mind how to describe what they're like. And she said a friend of hers tasted it, and he said he didn't like them because they tasted like eating rubber bands. And yeah. I thought that was a good description.
But I put it in the soup, so it softens it up.
Oh, nice. Yeah, good idea.
Yeah, but I also put zucchini noodles in my soup too. I mean, I'm not addicted anymore to any one particular thing. If I don't have it, I don't have it. On days I eat, I find if it's simple, organ meat, I make my own pate and rillette, and it's really good. I'll try and post recipes on my website, but I had a French house guest and she told me it was just like the one in France. And I'm like, oh my God, that's such a great compliment. Anyway, I was really excited, but I get my duck and my liver from the farmer's market here in Vancouver. So I know the lady who raises the duck and the animals, and it's such a nice, and the eggs for that matter. When I travel, I go and visit very poor people and I ask them, I go to villages, I sit on the floor and I watch them, watch what they eat, not what they feed me, what they're eating, because they're going to give me like good stuff. And they're eating the organ meat, very small portions. And even if I tell them, come on, eat my food, they'll say, no, that's okay, I just ate today. And you understand in India, everyone fasts, right, on a regular basis. I mean, that's like, I almost feel it's almost another whole podcast, because I've learned a lot about fasting from the experienced fasters. And there's nothing about experience there. It's part of how you're raised. And there's no books on fasting. There's no keto treats. There's no, how do I break my fast? I mean, sometimes I laugh to myself, obviously, and I understand. I'm not making fun of by any means I needed the book on fasting. But let me tell you, I've gone and apologized to some of my friends back home, because I used to make fun of them fasting. And I've had to apologize to them and say, you know, I'm so sorry that I didn't honor what you're doing. And like I was saying, there's so much I can talk about, because these people don't have the money for keto treats and books. They just learn from their grandmothers. So I've learned that you've got to go spend time not only with your grandmother, but ask your grandmother how her mother ate, because both my grandmothers ended up with dementia. And that was from the sugar and all of this. People might disagree with me, but I think we've got to ask grandmothers what their grandparents ate, because of how damaged our food society has been, right?
Yeah, need to go back further.
But in terms of, for me, I am so much healthier. You know, I work a lot now. I travel around the country. No, that's thanks to epilepsy too. You know, I mean, not having epilepsy, I can go. For example, I've been to some of the low-carb conferences just to go and attend and get knowledge, right, for me. I actually launched online vegetarian cooking classes. So that was kind of exciting after seeing I could heal my body and that there was not a lot for vegetarians. But let me tell you something, Daisy, it's easier for me to sell, like, say, a gourmet tea and people will just drop money at some, I have healing teas and they'll give me money for the teas. But the same people are walking to me with oxygen tanks and they're about 300 pounds. And I'll say, could you please consider just taking my cooking class because I also give you one-on-one support. And you know what they do? They drop another $100 on a tea. And I cry. I actually cry inside because, yeah, I could make more money. I do make more money when they buy a tea, but it's not an answer. Mm. You know, you have to have food and meditation and all these other things be an answer. I spent that money on magic remedies.
So that's the thing, isn't it? It's the easy fix. People are looking for an easy fix, a pill, a tea, whatever it is, something that's easy that you can take without making any changes.
And what I know for a fact, because it's so challenging for me, because I have some challenges inside of my body. So I know if other people would work, you know, they don't even have to work. I work 50 times harder than most people. I do. And it's something that I feel it's like a doctor telling you, you have to come for dialysis. That's what you do. You have to have chemotherapy and you do it. So for me, this is my food therapy. I got to eat every day at 8 a.m., like 4 days a week. And the other days, I don't eat. And I'm fine with it. So why do other people have a problem with it? That's what's going to help me with longevity. But in terms of what had happened to my body, I was losing my memory. I couldn't remember stuff. This is after, you know, having very high sugars and I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't move my thumb. There was all this joint issue. I had eczema everywhere. I had insomnia. I used to get really emotional to all these emotional ups and downs. You know what I'm talking about? Like, you know, just kind of get mad about things. And I have a dog. Well, my dog Coco was about 47 pounds. That's kind of how much excess weight I used to have. And she sleeps on our bed. And usually I never lift her up. My husband does. She can jump up. She's just being like a princess. So he had surgery recently and I had to lift her up. And without any effort, I lifted her on the bed. And I thought, I couldn't even lift 10 pounds 3 years ago. And I do like Tai Chi almost 3 days a week for 2 hours at a stretch. The pain's gone. This is a very interesting thing. I could not cut my fingernails. I didn't have the strength, especially in my right hand. Mm. And suddenly I realized the other day, wow, you're cutting your fingernails, no problem. And a boot, I couldn't remove one of my boots again, but it's the strength gone. It's little things. It doesn't seem like it's a big thing. But I would recommend to people that people write down the things, what is happening to you from head to toe now, and then write again as you see healing and then write it out again, because I do that and you'll forget that you even had some aches and pains.
It's like you say, you do forget. Interesting point that I can remember Alan Meisner talking about when I recorded a podcast with him talking about specifically, he was talking about exercise with aging and he was talking about grip strength. And it made me think then when you were saying about fingernails, and it just made me think grip strength. And he was saying that is a fantastic indicator actually of general health, is if your grip strength starts declining, of just the impact that has. You know, it doesn't seem that much. And when you're thinking about it, you're thinking, well, if you struggle to open a jar and it doesn't seem that much, you hand it to somebody else. But actually the ripple effect of that, it can come down to not being able to cut your fingernails, not being able to get a boot off. And that is the kind of thing that is a massive impact. It sounds like a little thing, but it's not. It's huge. So that's very interesting that you've reversed that and you've got that back again, that strength. To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share, and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Arthur Ashe. Start where you are. Use what you have. Do what you can. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.